The ladies I welcome with trepidation. This is a... I can't promise you wouldn't want to talk through this year, but I'm asking you still not to.
Maybe that won't help you.
It's a... This is a difficult pasuk and it raises a lot of issues, which we will only be able to touch on, but never been my way to completely shy away from anything. And I was actually hoping that we would have been able to wrap together both Adam and Chava's punishment, but I think there's really too much on both, and therefore we're going to have to divide up the two. A word of programming. Next week I will be away. There is no shiur next week. And I'm not sure. When is Purim? What's the date?
March 4th.
Purim is March 4th. So there's a good chance that that week will be the last shiur between Purim and Pesach. Maybe there'll be one. Maybe. We'll see. But keep that in mind. You should have your Wednesday nights free for all sorts of preparation. Now, who will be doing those preparations? Husband or the wife? So that relates a little bit to tonight's shiur. Okay. And remember, before, if you want to attack me in any way violently, there are four children who look up to me as their father, and they would like to see me come home tonight. Okay. Anyway, I'm just a messenger. Okay. Hopefully we'll have a good understanding of what's going on after tonight. Okay. So we have dealt with the snake, and now we are ready to go to Chava. Yet unnamed, but soon. That's only a few psukim away where she'll get her name Chava, but until now we'll be referring to her as Isha. So in Parak Gimel, Pasuk Tezayin, Hashem now turns his attention, El HaIsha, to the woman. Amar, and Hashem says, as a result, of course, of what she did, Harba Arbe Etzvonech, I will increase your suffering, Veheronech, and your pregnancy, Be'etzev tel dibanim, as you give birth to children. Be'elisheich teshukaseich, you will have some kind of a desire or a craving to your husband.
Nothing wrong with that.
I'm going to move my center over a little bit more to this side. V'hu yimshol bach. Now, I'm not sure exactly how to translate that. I mean, I know what the words mean, of course, but we will see different, all kidding aside, different explanations in the Mefarshim, what exactly that means. I want to mention, though, in light of this, I have three stories which I hope to tell over the course of tonight's shiur. I'm hoping that'll help things go a little better. But I want to mention one of them now, and that is that my son finds it amazing that here I am with grown-ups learning the same thing he's learning in school. In fact, he's already ahead of us. He's already on Parak Dalet. I try to explain to him that we're learning only once a week, and he gets to school every day. But last week he had finished Parak Gimel. And I can't remember what it was about, but there was something that he was very much asking me for, and it was near bedtime, and I have a very clear vision of this. He was up on his bunk bed, and he's begging me, and I told him that couldn't, because, and you know, he had already asked, and then mommy says no. And he looks at me and goes, but you're in charge. So I said, what are you talking about? Well, yeah, it says in the Chumash, Uhu Yim Shol Bach.
Oh. Beautiful.
Right. Best Rebbe in the world.
Oh,
wow. Okay, so I had explained to him, but I hope we'll be clear by the end of the shiur that that is not what it means.
He's got a great future.
That is not what it means. That is not what it means. You can ask him. I'm not just saying this now to you. This is what I told him. That is not what it means. I'll give you a companion story just to show you the reality of our life. I would say 6 or 7 years ago, my oldest daughter at the time may have still been my only child. I can't remember exactly. It was either 6 or 7 years ago. She was very precocious, and she has a certain tendency to be bossy. So that doesn't just relate to how she talks to her siblings. It even related to how she talked to her parents. And at one point, she was, again, maybe 2 or 3, maybe she was 4 years old, I can't remember. I said to her, you're not the boss. And she looks at me, and she goes, ah, but you're not the boss either. I said, what do you mean, who's the boss? Mommy's the boss. So she's absolutely correct. She's perceptive and... perceptive and correct. So with that hakdama, those two stories, and I'm still saving my third for the end of this year, I want to address the different aspects of this pasuk. Now, before we get into the issues which we are nervously laughing about, and speak about the specific punishment of Chava and its impact, obviously, on all of human history, I want to speak about what it's not. Not the specifics, but the big issue here. And this really doesn't just relate to Chava, but will also relate to Adam's punishment. You are familiar that these few psukim, these next three psukim, the one we're learning today and the next two and the one we'll learn next year, so these are taken as the basis of a central, incredibly important and profound basis for a central and profound cornerstone of Christian theology. And that is the concept of original sin. And the question is, if that is or isn't what we believe, and if not, well, how do we interpret these psukim? I'm not remotely an expert, and I don't want to get into too many details, even if some of you just correct me if you think if I'm wrong. But as I understand it, their understanding of the punishment of Adam and Chava was such that, so to speak, it's lahavdil of Alfevdalos, but it's kind of like some of our understandings of Mais Avosim and Labanim. In other words, it's imprinted into the DNA, so to speak, of all humans the rest of time. We are born as sinners. And as such, that's number one. Number two is that we don't really have a hope of rectifying that on our own. Since it predates anything we specifically did, it also cannot be changed by anything we specifically do. And therefore, it's only through the love or the salvation of who they worship that they can be saved. But they're fundamentally born into a process of sin and basically ultimately irredeemable without that external salvation. Now, that is very much not what we believe. And I just wanted to share with you, so there shouldn't be any confusion, two relatively recent, and you can imagine why this would only be taken up by more recent commentators, but two relatively recent explanations, one on the Parsha and one generally, which make it clear that Jewish philosophy rejects this notion. So first, from Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's commentary to our pasuk and our parsha here in general, right after Adam's punishment, he mentions in his both of these are very beautiful and poetically written. Hirsch says, "What a disconsolate lie," he says, referring to Christian theology. It's not just that it's not true, it's a lie, it's disconsolate, it's almost like depressing, it's deflating. It undermines the whole moral future of mankind, which has been forged out of this history. How can we have a moral responsibility, the freedom to do good and bad, to hopefully merit heaven or otherwise? According to their approach, it robs us of all of that. The dogma of original sin has been founded on it, the dogma upon which a whole structure has been built, against which, if anything, the whole being of a Jew has to raise the most emphatic protest. Right? All of our collective essences, our whole Jewish people, were in essence protesting against their philosophy. Why? Because of this idea, man has become sinful, in their view, has forfeited the ability to be good, and therefore must sin. That is his, you know, succinct summary of this theology. And against that belief, Judaism raises the most vehement protest. It's almost, it's even more than this, it's almost particularly sharp and ironic, according to those theories, such as the Ramban, who view the whole reaction of result of Eitz Hadas to be in the realm of Bechira Chafshis. In other words, what Rav Hirsch is particularly bothered by, and we'll see this from Rav Cook in a moment, is the notion that we believe as a cornerstone to Jewish thought in man's absolute free choice. And therefore, we have a choice to actually lift ourselves up from whatever innate inclinations or will be or propensity to sin, and to create for ourselves or for the world incredible things. And the assumption is that their belief ultimately robs them of this. And again, this has many, many ramifications. I don't want to get too far afield, but a friend of mine, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, has published, I think at least once, if not more than once, on this topic, and specifically made the point, he's going for a doctorate in this general area, so he's holding in it more than I am or would want to be, actually. We divided and conquered our academic studies, and I gave him that job, so to speak. But he pointed out, I think correctly, as I understand it, that this is not just in and of itself a debate, but this has major hashlachot, major ramifications. For example, the whole belief, which I have myself actually written about, of their, you know, this knee-jerk, blind, obsessive need to forgive, which we very much I think, reject. Forgiveness has to be earned. It's not given. Heaven has to be earned. It's not going to be given. So all of these things are interconnected. Because they believe that ultimately everyone's irredeemable unless there's this kindness from above, so it's lahavdil in a mahu afata, just like they believe that their God has this instinctive love and will just forgive everyone even if they haven't earned it. So they believe that they have to also. That's part of their theology. Where just like we believe that we're only going to merit Hashem's ultimate reward if we've earned it. Mahu afata, so too in this world. We don't just forgive people or look kindly upon the sinner or the evil person just because we quote-unquote love everyone. No, you have to earn that in this world just like you'd have to earn that in the next world. So that's a very practical difference in terms of the way we relate even in this world to people with Christianity, which may, I think, this is his suggestion, and it makes sense to me, really goes back to this ultimate issue. And again, it all goes back to this theology of original sin. And as Rapersh is writing here, it ultimately, it's not just a question of theology, it's a question of morality. And from our perspective, I mean, I'm sure if there was someone here who wanted to debate me, they could make an articulate defense. But since they're not here, I'll make our case. It robs mankind of a certain essential morality, which is basically human responsibility for the good and for the bad that we do. Just to see another source, which again also focused on this, Rav Kook, in a letter, also makes this point in a slightly different way. And he tells us that it is not to us whether what's important or what matters is not whether there truly existed in the real world a golden age, some pristine Garden of Eden type stage in which man delighted in the abundance of physical and spiritual good, or whether the actual world started at the bottom, you know, in sin, etc., and is just trying to go up to some heaven. It doesn't matter. What's important is, and this is the underlying part, all we have to know is that it is entirely possible, this is what we believe, it's possible for a person, even if he has risen to great rank and is ready for all honors, if he corrupts his way, this person can lose everything, harming himself and his descendants for many generations. And this we learn from the fact of Adam's existence in the Garden of Eden, his sin, and his expulsion. Of course there are things that we learn from Adam and Chava and what happened in the Garden of Eden and Gan Eden. Of course, the ramifications. But that's what we learn. Not that man is irredeemably flawed, but that no matter how great a person achieves, as Adam and Chava were at that moment, and you're always dependent on your choices, and you're always going to have to pay the price and accept responsibility for decisions that you make. This is the antithesis of what the scholars among the Gentiles, as well as those Jews who follow in their footsteps, think. Their reading of the Bible follows the Christian interpretation through which the world has become a prison. That's a very powerful and vivid image. Right? The world is a prison. We're trapped in this state and can't get out. The pure understanding, however, of joy and light in the Torah is based precisely on the sure guarantee of the past when a man was very happy. Because we have this model, you shouldn't think that you can never get past it. The very fact that we have, why do we need to know about it? If Adam and Chava and the story of Gan Eden is in the Torah, right, we don't know, the Torah doesn't talk about the world of the angels and what's going on there, because it's irrelevant to us. The fact that Gan Eden is in the Torah, basically, is the point that he makes now, is to give us a model that even though our life is not as idealistic and idyllic as that world, it is attainable in this world through our own efforts. We can reclaim such closeness with Hashem, such physical pleasures, such spiritual pleasures, that's all within our grasp. And that we're not in that prison, which they, so to speak, see themselves in. And then just to finish up the last part, he says, and that's the reason, it's only man existence in the Garden of Eden that preserves for us that world of light. As we have this as a dogma, as a metaphor, as an example, as something to, so to speak, think back on what we could re-achieve. Thus, it is fitting to be practical and historical truth as well, even though this is not acceptable. In other words, he's alluding to the fact that some people say, well, maybe the Gan Eden never really happened. Is it just a metaphor? And Rav Kook's point is, from a Hashkafa perspective, it's irrelevant. It wouldn't be inconceivable that the Torah was speaking in a metaphor. He's not saying it is. But that's not the point. The point is that there is this notion that we human beings, which Adam and Chava were, despite whatever uniquenesses they had, that what they had, we can still achieve. And that is literally the opposite, it's the antithesis of what they see from the story, where they see it as this ultimate fall from grace and inability to get back. So I think it's an important introduction. We often don't focus on this, and I think often we have this vague notion of what they believe, and we have some vague notion that we don't agree with that, but it's not, shouldn't be vague. It should be clear, and it should be very heartfelt. You can hear the passion in the pen of both Rav Kook and Rav Hirsch, and there's good reason for it. And even though we'll spend now and the next year focusing on the
resulting punishments to Adam and Chava. And again, it is true, the punishments to Adam and Chava weren't just felt by them. They're felt by every woman and by every man throughout history. Nevertheless, we should realize that despite that fact, it's still very, very different than the Christian interpretation. Okay, that's my, so to speak, introduction. Let's go back now to the Pasuk and let's see the first Rashi comment. Rashi tells us, and it's really a paraphrase of a Gemara in Erevin. Let's first see it in Rashi, then we'll see the longer version on the source sheet, the Gemara itself. Rashi, paraphrasing this Gemara, tells us that we can basically break up the pasuk to be referring to different things. What does it say? Etz bonech, right? Woman will have a certain suffering, so that's a vague term, says the Gemara. Zet sa'ar gidol banim, Rashi says. That is the particular anguish of raising children. Right? It's not easy to raise kids. Well, everyone thinks that this generation is the hardest, but they thought that last generation is not the generation before. There are unique challenges, but it was always hard, and it always will be hard. That was a punishment. It didn't have to be, but that's a result of the sin. Good. Yeah. Correct. But apparently, there's a sense, we'll see this in the Gemara as well, that that burden is carried more by the mother than by the father. Heronech, this gets more particular, obviously, to women, your pregnancy. Zet sar ha'ibur, this is the pain of pregnancy itself. Again, the act, we're not talking about giving birth, we're talking about the very act of being pregnant. The etzev tel dibanim, in the pain you shall bear children. Zet sar ha'leda, this is the pain of actually giving birth. Pasuk continues, the El Ishech Teshukaseich, you'll have a certain craving or desire for your husband, says the Gemara Latashmish. This is referring to physical intimacy between husband and wife. But what, so in what way is that somehow a curse? And certainly it's almost counterintuitive. You know, generally the assumption is in Chazal and throughout human history that men have more of an inclination towards that. So in what way is this a bad thing, or in what way is this in any way hurting the woman? So the Gemara, in, again here Rashi is paraphrasing, tells us, even though you know, it's part of a natural female instinct to have a desire for this, nevertheless, Ein lach meitzach l'tavah bepeh. Meitzach is a metaphor here. It literally means a forehead, but basically it's a way of saying you don't have the nerve l'tavah bepeh. In other words, if a husband and wife are in a private moment and a wife is interested, she's not necessarily going to feel comfortable expressing that directly to her husband, but rather she'll have to hint it or something like that. And apparently that, the impression that Rashi gives at least, is that the fact that a woman is unable, again, in this case perhaps she puts the brakes on herself, to particularly express what she wants to her husband, that is itself considered a form of a punishment. In fact, that's how we understand the conclusion of the Pasuk, and this was very much not taught to my first grade son in TA, but I guess, even though I don't know if he got the right shot, at least I understand why they didn't teach him this shot. V'hu yimshol bof, says Rashi, hakol mimenu v'lo mimeich. In other words, the very fact, again, Rashi seems to understand it as specifically relating not to every aspect of their lives, but to this particular aspect of their lives. And because a woman is not going to initiate, therefore, whether they're intimate or not, will be dependent more on whether he's willing to initiate. V'hu yimshol bach. That is the basically the approach of the Gemara. And then just to conclude, the last one, teshuka seich, your craving, what does that mean? Ta'ava seich, your desire. K'mo b'nafsho shekaga. Okay, but not really adding anything on that particular point so much. So basically what you have here, according to the Gemara, is a multi-layered approach in which a woman's constituency and her personality was affected for all eternity in ways which either create extra burdens on her, whether it comes to child rearing, extra pain when it comes to carrying the baby and giving birth to the baby, and a certain imbalance in at least one part of the relationship between husband and wife. Now, I should have probably pointed out already, and may need to point out more than once during the shiur, the remainder of the shiur, and that is that I don't think there's anything wrong with making the point that we're obviously speaking about typologies here, or generalizations. Generalizations because they're generally true. But I don't think that at any given point, you know, there's nothing wrong with a given person if they don't fit into every little point of this category. It's not by definition, again, it could be in theory, especially if it would be an extreme. But per se, obviously, when we speak about these types of things, they are intentionally generalizations. I think there has to be some level of truth in all of them, or else that would present a problem for us. But that doesn't mean that they have to be identical exactly and take the form. Obviously, every person is different, and that doesn't just mean every man, but it means every woman as well. And the punishments as they affect Adam will obviously also not be borne by every man in an identical way. And it doesn't make any sense to me to assume that they would be born by every woman in the identical way. Just to also mention something which is interesting, one of the Mefarshei Rashi point out that the fact that the order here in the Pasuk focuses on child rearing before giving birth, which is chronologically obviously out of order, it's out of sequence, to point out that even though, I thought this is just it's a very obvious point, but it was a kind of a neat deal, it was very sharply pointed out, and that is that even though, of course, the rest of history, first people get pregnant and have the pain of childbirth, and then have the tzar gil banim, you have the challenge of raising children, and even though that's going to affect all women throughout history, the bottom line was at this point, Hashem is talking to a person. Her name is Chava. And the reason the order was reversed is because, as Rashi is going to tell us, actually in the first pasuk of Perek Dalet, before the whole sin of the Eitz Hadas, Chava had already become pregnant with her children, with Cain and Hevel, and she had already given birth. In fact, the Gemara says it was a simultaneous, almost, and a painless process. Otherwise, you were intimate, you conceived, and you gave birth all on the same day, and there was no pain in it. So for Chava, the first most immediate issue, which we know she's going to have Nebuch, more tzaris than almost any mother could imagine, right? One son killing another. So Tzar Gidol Banim, that was right away already relevant to her. That Heroneich and Etzet Tel Dibanim, that was not yet relevant to her. So that's why otherwise order doesn't make any sense. So on the one hand, it's talking to women throughout history. On the other hand, it's first and foremost talking to Chava, and therefore that order. I thought that was a nice little point, which I think we could have missed had it not been pointed out for us. Take a look at your source sheet now, and let's see the Gemara. The Gemara is actually more colorful, if you will, and actually throws a lot more punishments on Chava than Rashi actually paraphrases. Gemara is actually a related but a broader context, so I don't want to get into where the Gemara was going from. In fact, we may have to skip a line or two because it relates to the broader discussion. But in the context of a broader discussion, the Gemara quotes the following teaching in the name of Rav Yitzchak Bar Avdimi. Eser klolos niskala chava. She actually got 10 punishments. And it goes through our pasuk, sees them all encoded, it seems, in our pasuk. Or at least most of them, as we'll see. The pasuk tells us, Ela Isha to Chava, it said, Amar Hashem says, Harbeh Arbeh. Why is the double language of Harbeh Arbeh? I will greatly increase. That's how I translate it, but really, why does it have to say two? So here, interestingly, the Gemara says, Elu Shnei Tipe Damim. This is referring to two bleedings that women have, which can be painful. Achas Damnida, her menstrual cycle, the Achas Dabasulim, hymenal bleeding. So these are two things which can be associated with blood and can be painful for women. And both of these, again, didn't have to have been part of it. This was not Hashem's original plan. These are results, rather, of Chava's punishment. Continuing, Etzbonech, which we already saw now paraphrased by Rashi, Zet Sar Gidol Banim. This is the pain of raising children. The Heronech, Zet Sar HaIbor. This is giving birth. The Etzev Tel Dibanim. Excuse me, Zahar Ibor, excuse me, thank you. Zahar Ibor, that's actually being pregnant. Be'etzav tel dibanim, kemashmo, that means giving birth. Ve'el isheich, teshukasech, has this craving or desire for her husband. Malamish ha'ishta mishtokekes al ba'ala, v'shash yotze l'derach. It's interesting, here there's almost more of an emotional component. Perhaps, again, it's somewhat, again, we're speaking stereotypically, an imbalance in the psychological or emotional needs that a woman would have as opposed to her husband. If they're separated, who, in a sense, misses the other more, says the Gemara, it's really when it comes to a woman. And again, as I say, I think this is probably true in most cases. Whether it would be true in every case, I don't know. Just this week, someone whose husband is in Eretz Yisrael for a short period saw both me and my wife separately, and both times told us, you know, we can't believe it, every year your husband goes to Israel for a week, and you have little kids, and my husband's only away for 4 days, and my kids are already older, and I can't sleep at night, and I'm thinking about him, and it's a real thing. It's a real thing. Again, whether it applies to every woman in every case, I don't know, but it resonates with the reality that I'm familiar with. That I could say. Hu Yimshal Bach, again getting conclusion of our Pasuk, Malamish Ha'isha, this is again was already paraphrased by Rashi, Malamish Ha'isha Tova'as Belev, that when a woman is interested, she's not necessarily going to come right out and express that desire to her husband, rather Tova'as Belev, she has to be a little bit more subtle, Ha'ish Tova'a Bepeh, whereas a man might be less reserved and may be willing to be more expressive about his desires to his wife. Zuhi Mida Tova Banashim. So the Gemara asks, well, one second, this, what that really sounds like is that women are more tsanua. That doesn't sound like a curse, that sounds like a nice thing, a compliment to women. So the Gemara says, well, we have to rephrase a little bit, Kika Amrinan, Demartie Artsuye Kame, that it has to do with when he has perhaps, when there's an interest that's been expressed, she can always, in a way, even when it could be tsanua, she's still not able to express in a way that perhaps she would want to otherwise. Now, it's interesting that the Gemara points out for anyone who is counting that that's not 10. Hani Sheva Havyan, that's only 7, right? Sounds like it's enough, but the Gemara says, hey, you said 10. I want 10 punishments. That's only 7. Well, says the Gemara, and this is interesting, very interesting itself, this is already now not in Rashi, because it has nothing with the Pasuk, so it's really, we're kind of off the ranch, so to speak. Kiyasa Rabdimi Amar, he says, well, there are 3 others, and they're each one kind of vague and trying to difficult to understand. Number one is Atufa Ka'abel, she's wrapped up like a mourner. What does that mean? So the Mepharshim explained that's an allusion to the fact that she covers her hair. Now, I think that's fascinating, because many women, especially many modern women, look at hair covering as something difficult and something almost discriminatory. You see from this Gemara that they're not far off. They're not entirely wrong. It's still a mitzvah. We hopefully accept it. We hopefully practice it. But the Gemara here basically makes clear that's part of the punishment. And the metaphor used, that tufa ke'evil, wrapped up like a mourner, but like, it's not a flattering image. It's not. Now, again, I don't want to get too far afield, not a shear on head covering, but I find this to be a very, very fascinating, again, because sometimes the reaction of the frum community is to demonize women who express that perspective. I think that's a mistake. It's a mistake, certainly from a Kira perspective, but it may just be wrong.
How do you know that refers to?
I wouldn't have known on my
own. The hair rather than just the general body.
I wouldn't have known. But I don't remember who. I think it's, Rashi. I can't remember. I think it's what the Mepharshim say.
It can't refer to Shaitan. It must refer to a tickle.
Initially, yes, correct. That's correct. I think that may be correct. It happens to be, and again, not to get into this topic, but as you may know, and I don't know if this Gemara is cited, but Shaitlach have always been controversial. And they're considered to this very day by certain communities to be way too lenient. There are certain communities to this very day, more so in Israel than in America, where it would be completely unacceptable to show up in a sheitel. Completely unacceptable. So perhaps this Gemara would relate to that. But again, not to talk about that topic, but that's not really tonight's topic. Umenuda mikol adam, and this one that we're going to have to see is not clear at all. The Gemara itself is going to address. Menuda is so separated or isolated from everybody. What does that mean? We don't know yet. V'chavusha b'vesa asurin, which doesn't sound that much different, that somehow she's locked up in prison. Doesn't sound like such a pleasant thing. So the Mepharshim explained that the last point, chavusha b'vesa asurin, is again, certainly harsh imagery, but it's an allusion to the notion of tznius. And this is the more overall idea. The fact that, again, perhaps the details will depend on time and place, but the notion that women are more, and are supposed to be, more private and more inward focused, both whether it means in terms of a personality or even in terms of geographically, literally just are they out or are they more in? So without getting into the details, which may very well be subject to time and place, but that idea where, again, it's more for the women than the men, that is being alluded to here. And again, I repeat the same ha'ara, which to me is like obvious from the Gemara, if you're familiar with the Gemara, which is the same thing I just said a minute ago about hair covering, which is that very often, not just from girls who are women who are not brought up from, very often our own daughters, our own children, we ourselves sometimes have an instinct that there's a perspective, that the overall gist of the laws of tznius are unfair or too restrictive. And again, without getting into the details, but the general perspective, it doesn't seem to be that far off from what this Gemara says. And a chanami, the Gemara is saying, it's a little bit unfair, and that's a result of the punishment. If you will, I don't mean to be flippant about it, take your complaint up with Chava. You're right, it's a little bit of a punishment. You're right. That may be the way it has to be now. I'm not questioning whether it has to be or can't be. But the fact is, we shouldn't deny what seems to be the reality, which is that sometimes it can be a little bit difficult. And in fact, that is exactly not a coincidence, but the purpose, because it is apparently one of the punishments. Just to finish up the Gemara, we go back to that one middle one where we think isolated from people. What does that mean? My menuda mikoladam, what does that mean that she has to be alone from people? So the Gemara says, well, perhaps ilayim amishum to aser le'yichud. If you think, well, it means that she can never be alone with a man, there's something called isra yichud. The Gemara asks the obvious question, ihu nami aser le'yichud. But men also have the prohibition of yichud, so that can't be what it's referring to. Ella, the asira lebe trei. Interestingly enough, again, another thing which is often pointed out, and the Gemara seems to here acknowledge it, the fact that there's an imbalance about how many men a woman can marry, as opposed to how many women a man can marry. Again, it's going back already to over 1,000 years of Rabbeinu Gershom, where men are not allowed to marry more than one woman either. But we all know that in the Torah itself, a man is allowed to have multiple wives. Some of our greatest forefathers did as well. Whereas even from the Torah perspective, a woman is an adulteress if she's married to anything more than one man. And again, I could take any number of books off the shelf which would cite that as chapter and verse as part of the Torah's discrimination against women. So if it fits into some overall terrible, you know, indictment of the Torah, so of course I think we should deny that because it's not true. And it's a slander against the Torah. But that the fact is that there is an imbalance. You know, you can't call day, night, night, day. They're right. It is an imbalance. And you could argue, even though the whole concept is foreign to all of us men and women, but yes, in a society where that was plausible, was this something that was less fair to women? And the answer from this Gemara is yes. We're not denying it. You don't have to fight and say, no, it's really fair to women. It wasn't. But it was on purpose. It's not a coincidence. We're aware of that fact. It's part, says the Gemara, of the punishment. So this Gemara doesn't seem to make any attempt to do that. We will see other Mefarshim who whether they're connecting to this Gemara or having a complete interpretation, are much more of the Barbanel, especially Harry. We have one more Barbanel for you, which I was unexpecting. I was not expecting it. I thought we were done with it when we left the snake, but we're going to get back to the Barbanel one more time. The Barbanel very much tries to do me the Kinegimizer, for example. Yes, and I think the answer to that is yes, she did two things wrong. Number one is she ate, and number two is that she got her husband to eat. It's unquestionably. Yeah?
With the punishment of the snake, it specifically says that it'll be between their offspring also. But that's not mentioned.
Yeah, good point.
That it's for generation to generation.
It's a good observation.
And also, why did they use...
Again, the only point, which, again, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but we know that it has to be, right? Because
yeah,
given birth.
Right.
Okay, so
I'm also curious, why did they use Vayomer with the snake and Amar?
Oh, Amar, okay, that I'm not sure, but the fact that there's a little bit of a different reference, so Robin is going to pick up on that. I don't know if that's going to answer your question, but hold it till then. Because
okay.
If he doesn't, then no one else did.
Okay.
Maybe we'll come up with something on our own, but I think he may. He may. Yeah, please. Good question. It's a good question. I could give you an answer off the top of my head, but it probably deserves a better answer than I could think of, so I'm not sure. Let's leave it at that. Okay, it's a good question. If I was giving a shiur more on Hashkafas HaTorah, there's roles of women, etc., so I'd have to have a better prepared answer. The question was, if these are considered punishments, so how come some of them, not all of them, but how come some of them have been turned into mitzvos? Mitzvos implies something more positive. So I think the answer is obviously that there has to be some combination, some mixture, but whether I could articulate that in a way that I would be otherwise happy with, I don't know if I can off the top of my head. So I'd rather not say anything then. But it's a good question. It definitely needs to be thought about more. Let's take a look at some midrashim, which, again, not necessarily contradict this, but complement this Gemara. Again, midrashim also from the worldview and the thought of Chazal. So first of all, the first medrash really is exactly, we can leave that out in a sense, the first medrash is really identical to the Rashi paraphrase of the Gemara, except for one addition, which is in the middle, Be'etzev, it's broken up there, Zetzar HaNefalim, it's referring to miscarriages, which can be a particularly painful experience and traumatic experience for women. That's the only addition really in that particular medrash.
Right, but I'm saying the end of the thing, what's referred to... Right, but the basic idea is between the Gemara and Rashi, which is paraphrasing the Gemara, that it refers to pregnancy, childbirth, and Tzarki Lebonim. So that's... I understand saying, so maybe it's broken up differently, but it's ultimately the same thing, except for the addition of the Nephilim, I think. Okay, but let's take a look at the next Medrash. The next Medrash is interesting, especially if it adds something which is actually more well-known, quoted by Rashi from a Gemara, but it's also in this Medrash. So the Medrash continuing on, Elishech Teshuk HaSeich, so here the Medrash again broadens the theme and talks about Arba Teshukos Hain. And it talks about actually three others, which I didn't include in the source sheet. But basically the idea, as the Mefarshi HaMedrash point out, is that basically the Medrash is focusing on the word teshuka, because they have other words to describe desire or inclination or want. And the focus here, apparently the Medrash is driving at, is that other types of words refer to things which are logical desires. By which I mean that when it's logical to desire, one would, and when it's illogical, one would not. However, there are four, the Medrash says, four urges or desires in the world, by which, again, one of the four is refers to Hashem. I mean, it doesn't just mean human, it's cosmic here, which are so built into the way Hashem created the world, they're part of the spiritual, foodstuff of the world, that they are so, necessary, that even when they don't make sense, they still exist. They're that compelling to the person, even when they can be irrational. That's how essential they are. And the first of the four, there are three others, but the first of the four that the Medrash lists is from our pasuk of a woman to her husband. And again, I'm hesitant to get too far afield from this because I don't even know if I'm on firm footing. But again, I think that most human experience bears this out. In other words, it's not. We all know there are plenty of men who are completely obsessed and crazy sometimes about a particular woman or women in general. That's obviously true. But even in a more normal, healthy situation, as was alluded to by the Gemara itself, when the Gemara talked about her husband is going out of town, so there's a certain emotional or psychology, psychological reality, which I think this Medrash is also referring to, where you do see that imbalance. Just to give you as an example, this is it's almost a twisted example, but I think one which in extreme illustrates the point. I've dealt with this unfortunately. We all know it's not entirely uncommon. It's less common nowadays, but it's still relatively common for women to stay in relationships which are very unhealthy. You do not have a comparable reality in the other direction. And I'll say you never do, but it's not remotely comparable. A wife is making, or a girlfriend is making her boyfriend miserable, physically or emotionally, 9 times out of 10 they're going to leave. And I don't know exactly what the numbers are, I don't want to misspeak, but it's not identical. We all know, some of us may be related to people, have friends who've been in these situations where they know logically they should get out, and they can't. And they can't. Certain emotional or fear or other things that grip them more. It's an imbalance. And again, it's a difficult thing. And again, at least according to this tradition of Chazal, it's again that imbalance, that you could say weakness, susceptibility, that really goes back, again, according to this approach, to punishment of Chazal. Another interesting one to switch to something more pleasant, I hope, pleasant if we can speak about childbirth as being a pleasant thing, a happy thing, even if it's difficult in the moment, is exactly what the Medrash refers to. It's a very famous Medrash, it's also a Gemara Maseches Nida, and relates to the carbon that a woman has to bring as a result of having a baby. And the Gemara here says that, I never asked, but again, speaking in generalities, the Gemara says that a woman, when she's having the pain of childbirth, so she's in so much pain that she may curse, and she may even swear off ever being with her husband again, because the results are so painful. What happens? As time goes on, and she regrets that. She changes her mind. So she has to bring a carbon. That's the idea. Then she says, because to atone for this oath that she took in vain. But nevertheless, that's the idea, says the Medrash, or this opinion of Elishech Teshuk HaSeich, that even though, cognitively, this could result in another pregnancy, another type of pain, nevertheless, a woman doesn't necessarily leave her husband or become chaste all of a sudden, even though at the moment she may have swore off it. But the result is, human nature is that we go back
Eli Sheikh Tashumasek, that is the suggestion. In a more general sense, I mean, this I have heard from more than one woman, is not so much because of her husband, but because of children. In other words, you even sometimes read this in one of these, sometimes in some of the light pregnancy books, they speak about how, you know, God made us with short memories for a reason, because if we didn't, we would never have another child after you've had the first. But, right, well, women who can, most of them, are interested in having, you know, and if they're not, it's not because of the pain of the actual labor. Some women, it doesn't fit with the lifestyle that they want, but it's not because of the pain of childbirth. Most normal women, despite the incredible agony they have to go through, whether it's for their husbands or for their love of children, are willing to do that more than once. And that, again, according to this medrash, is also, so to speak, part of that tradition. It's interesting, I thought a comment of the Sephorno, I don't know if anyone else really says this, other than that it was picked up a little bit by that Gemara at first, but I didn't see any of the other Mefarshim on the Chumash point out what the Sephorno does. He's the only one who brings out the idea, and he specifically links it to one of the words that perhaps, if we're speaking about pain and unique feminine pain, so he points out that it could be referring to Dam Nida, the menstrual cycle, which, as we know, can be painful for women. And he also points out something else that we saw. Again, he's one of the only who pointed it out, but it was all going back to that original Gemara and that Medrash, the Heronech, says the Sforno, that this is all new, because it didn't have to be. It wasn't that way. The Chava had already experienced this entire process without any pain. It could have been painless, but it wasn't as a result of her mistake. The Radak, also again, in light of this general approach, the Radak has a nuance. The Radak breaks up with the length of a pregnancy and the actual pain of the pregnancy. He says, Exponech is COVID, Hareyon, that's the pain, and that's what the other sources had said. But then he adds, I think unique to the Radak, the Heronech, Arichus, Imeh Hareyon, the length of the pregnancy. I don't know if it's in this year, but I have mentioned this in other contexts. I think it's been true with virtually every year, maybe literally every one of our children's births that during the pregnancies. My wife is often made the point when she gets to the 9th month, it's the length. She goes, you know, she always says, pregnancy will be perfect, it was just 8 months. But the length itself, sometimes it's, there are so many other things which are more obviously difficult, but sometimes a more subtle and but just as difficult and painful thing can be for people of the length, especially if you're in the end of the summer and you live in a place like Baltimore or New York City where it's incredibly hot and humid. It can be very, very difficult. I want to mention now, if we can, to close the shir, two other sources, and then hopefully end on a broader note from the Rambam, but two other sources on our Pasuk, which, again, not necessarily entirely different than the Gemara, but broadening and adding something, because really these other Mepharshim that I just mentioned are really just shading and adding and augmenting this Gemara and the Medrash. But the next two sources really have something, I think, unique, especially the Barbanel, but even the Netziv and the Ha'amek Dover, something unique to contribute. Says the Netziv and the Ha'amek Dover, the El Ishech, the Shuk Aseich, what does that mean? That a woman will have a desire for her husband. So until now, we have seen, what is the Medrash and the versions of it? That it seems to be more focused on, as Rashi has said, on issues of intimacy, that there's a desire for intimacy, but an inability to express it in an overt way, desire for intimacy, even though it can lead to pregnancy and other things which are difficult and painful, but nevertheless, that's the whole aware of what we have seen until now. But the Ha'amek Dover says, you know what, there may be a very simple explanation, which is not so much physical, if you will, but rather just psychological or emotional. The Pshat says the Netziv, the most simple understanding is Ha'isha mishtokekes tamid shehei noses chein bein ha'isha. A woman has, and again, here the impression is, not great, but greater, as he'll say explicitly in the next line, that while it's true that everyone, most human, it's human nature to want to be liked, and it's especially human nature to want to be liked by the people you're closest with, and obviously a spouse would be the top of that list. Nevertheless, as an Tziv, there is an imbalance. Again, there are exceptions in both directions, obviously, but says the Tziv, on balance, a woman has a greater need to be, so to speak, loved by her husband, or in a positive vein by her husband, than a husband would have for his wife. And he continues and says, "Zed diuk loshon ve'el isheich." He wants to infer that in the formulation of the pasuk. He also says that that may be what the Medrash was referring to when it said dalat teshukos. There are four types of teshuka, of desire. And again, he says that wasn't specifically focusing just for sexual desire. It's a much more broader idea, the notion of wanting, you know, things to be on an emotional plane. You know, can you, who who is more likely to be able to live with some tension or some lack of communication? Who needs to have more expressive reassurances of I love you and things like this? So again, I don't think that a tziv lived a little while ago, but I don't think that much has changed. I think, again, there are exceptions in both directions. There are, in this sense, if you will, more masculine women and more feminine men. But generally speaking, I think he's onto something, that there is this imbalance. If it would be too extreme either direction, it might not be healthy for the person and certainly for the marriage. But even in wonderful and healthy marriages, there are different needs that husband and wife usually bring to the relationship. And it's the ability to be able to relate to your wife as a woman that is important for men to learn, and you don't know that the first day you get married, trust me. And it's also, as you all know, but it's also true in the other direction. Again, because there's a difference, so women have to realize in the end that's part of the growth of marriages and couples coming together is not just knowing your spouse as a unique person, but knowing them as a species, knowing that men think differently than women, and women can think differently than men. And as he says in the Tziv, kach b'zeh, there's a certain imbalance, a certain difference between the way men are wired and women are wired. I don't think he necessarily would have thought of it, but I guess he wouldn't have been against that famous book, right? Where the men are. Yes, so that's exactly what the Hamei Gavur is saying. It's exactly Mamish. You could have given a haskama to the book. Ha'ish, he continues, Eino choshesh, shehei no seichein v'ishto, he says, but a man is not as interested, it's not as important to him that his wife is at that moment, you know, so to speak, thinking highly of him. Ha'isha, he continues, kol mayaneha, all of her desires, all of her machinations, her wishes, sheha'ish noach mimena, that her husband should love her and find favor with her, v'imkein. And in that sense, this is how the Tziv concludes and understands the end of the pasuk, he tfeila elav. There's a certain balance, again, like in any relationship, could be lavdil, it could be like a, you know, in an office relationship. A person who doesn't care what other people think of him and is willing to do things in a way doesn't have to be beholden to that, so there's a certain advantage to that. That may not be envious, but a certain advantage to it. The fact that someone is constantly worried, well, will the other person like me? Will I find favor in their eyes? So that's inhibiting. That's a little bit of an imbalance. And says in the Tziv, that's what's referred to. Again, not at all the way my son thought from school of a hu yimshal b'chazon with power and control. Chas b'shalom. Any marriage is about power and control is a horrible marriage in either direction. But that's not what's being referred to. It says in the Tziv, but there's an emotional, the fact that a woman needs the reassurances and the positive reinforcement from her husband more than he may need it from her, again, stereotypically speaking, so there's a little bit of an imbalance there. She needs him more than he needs her in that perspective. Other mepharshim point out, we'll see this connected to the punishment of Adam, once the world changes and food and, you know, parnassah is only going to be accomplished with physical exertion, so the fact that Hashem made most men stronger than most women, that may also be part of this equation, that in that sense, a man is more capable of living on his own than a woman. Another thing to mention, I'm sorry for rushing, but there's just so much here, I think it's all condemned. Sorry?
I think the women are going to give you a private lesson.
I don't think I've added almost anything original. I'm just telling you what the Mepharshim point is. Okay, I can learn from everybody. I can learn from that. But again, I haven't seen anything that's too radical here. But as I say, I'm just sharing you these makaros. The Abar Benel, getting to Harry, you ready?
Yeah.
Harry, this is it. I thought last night was the bottom of the ninth, but we have one more inning to go, Harry. So the Abar Benel points out the following. Lo Amar Lo. Abar Benel has a whole different shot than everything we've seen until now, more or less. Lo Amar La, says the Abar Benel, the Torah does not say that Hashem says to Chava, Ki Shamat L'Kol HaNachash, the pasuk does not read, well, Chava, since you listen to what the Nachash said to you, as I command you not to do that. Right? That's not what the Torah says. Again, I'm not sure what you were asking me before, that's what I was alluding to. Whereas the Torah starts off by telling the Nachash, since you didn't listen to me, since you did this to the woman, but then, since the Torah is going to mention that with Adam and Chava, how come you listened to Chava and didn't listen to me? We're going to see that when we talk about Adam. But that's not what it says to Chava. It does not say, since you listened to the Nachash and didn't listen to me. And that's not what the Pasuk says. The Pasuk does not actually specify why Hashem is punishing her. We know, but Hashem doesn't tell us that. It doesn't say, because you listened to the Nachash. So you and I could just think, okay, because we already know. Says the Abar Benel, it's because she didn't listen to the Nachash. The Nachash didn't talk. It all fits into his theory and his pattern. This fits in to everything I've been saying until now. Why didn't Hashem mention that? Because it didn't happen. The snake didn't give her anything to eat. Says the Barbanel, this is Nagaraya, another proof for what I have said. The fact is that all it was the snake doing what snakes do, and Chava saw it eat from the tree, and she became so desirous and jealous that she imagined that it was actually talking when really it wasn't. B'inya, now he says, Klalasa, when it comes to her punishment, Echshov, he says, Kefisha haisa mida keneged mida. Now here, the Abravanel, who suggests that this is all mida keneged mida. It's very deliberate punishing of Chava. And basically, he assumes, I'm going to paraphrase this because otherwise we won't have time to finish, I don't want to keep you too late. The Abravanel assumes that basically what she was interested in, again, this goes back to what the Eitz HaDaas was, what it represented. And we have seen a number of different theories had to do with free choice, Bechir Chavshis, but one recurring theme we've seen in a certain strain of sources is that it relates to sexual desire. What's known in Chazal, the Barbanel refers to it as Mishkal, Memshin, Gimel Lamed. That the fact, as we saw until now, that the way they related to their bodies was different after the Eitz HaDaas, they related to each other, even though according to these many Midrashim they had already been intimate, but the way they related to that action as beforehand being no different than eating, just a regular biological function, and then after the Eitz HaDaas, that changed. That there is a whole group of Mefarshim, a whole Masorah and Chazal that see that very much connected to Eitz HaDaas. And Abravanel constantly, consistently, I believe, takes that approach. And here too, in that vein, says the Abravanel, you, see, Hashem says to Chava, ate this tree and gave it to your husband in light of this idea. That's why you were doing it. But despite the fact that that was the stated result, an obvious result of eating from Eitz HaDaas, he says, and I'm reading now just to paraphrase if you want to follow, five lines down, Ein Safek, says Hashem, even though I know that's generally, but really I'm not exactly sure, it's one of three different things. Le'echad Megimol Tachlios. There's one of three different things you were trying to gain through this. Again, he sees this as not some innocent or, you know, astronomical desire that she had, she couldn't control it. Her mouth water, you know, her mouth was watering. Ooh, this delicious fruit. The Barbanel sees some. This is much more conniving on Chava's part. She understood what the Eitz HaDaas would give her, and she wanted that. Now, why did she want it? What was she going to gain? How was she going to alter the world? So says the Abravanel, Hashem, in essence, tells her, I'm not exactly sure, but it could have been any one of three different things. One is to increase your general pleasure in the world. There was a greater heightened sense of sensuality and pleasure that Adam and Chava would have once they ate the fruit. Perhaps that's what you wanted. That's option number one. Number two is Inyan Haladas Banim. Perhaps you wanted that because all of a sudden now there was a pleasure associated with procreation. If you maybe it wasn't the pleasure that you wanted, maybe you want lots of children. So you wanted to have the fruit so that that element would be introduced into procreating, and obviously that would be a way of enticing your husband to be procreating with you. And number three, he says, is perhaps it's not neither of those. Perhaps it's just a general you want your husband to love you more and to be thinking about you and desirous of you. So if the relationship now includes this form of pleasure, perhaps that would be a way that you'd be able to, so to speak, have your husband on a shorter, chain. That's the three basic ideas that the Abravanel says. Any one or multiple of those three, that was what Chava's goal was. And in light of that, says the Abravanel, L'chein kilva keneged shloshtam. The phrases of the pasuk correspond, he suggests, mida keneged mida, to those three possibilities. Number one, im bakashas tanug v'arvos yebehefech, shehar ve'erve etzvonech. If you thought that there's going to be more pleasure in the world, well look, all of these different things, again, you could add in whatever details you want, whether it's a menstrual cycle, whether it's hymenal bleeding, damasulim, we saw one opinion, whether it's childbirth, child rearing, all these things, there's a lot more pain in the world than there would have been before you ate the fruit. You thought you were going to have more pleasure in the world. Now you have added, you're punished. There's a whole element of your life that is difficult and painful. It wouldn't have been otherwise. And he adds, that's the part that I've been underlined, says the Abravanel, it's not just limited to particular things which are unique to women, as I just alluded to. Abravanel wants to go even further. In general, he says, women are either susceptible more to difficulties, whether it be sicknesses or pains, or even if they're not susceptible anymore, because they're naturally weaker than men, the same
ailment can afflict her more. So says the Abarbanel, and the Abarbanel doesn't want anyone to shoot him because they're upset at him, so he hides behind. He wants to quote the scientists, the doctors. He says, no, we have medical science that tells us, the Abarbanel, in 15th century Spain, that this is true, that there's a difference between physiologically men and women, and they are more susceptible or carry pain and difficult and illnesses more difficultly. So you thought, Chava, you were going to get more pleasure in the world, you really have a weakened state and more pain. That's possibility number one. Possibility number two was that you wanted to be a mother. Lios ema banimus meichel. You thought, oh, more kids, it's all wonderful, right? It's all good, all kids. Lo yekein, won't be that way at all. Kehema yisrabe etzmanech v'heronech. Because delivering them will be painful, raising them will be painful. So that's number two. And number three, perhaps you thought, Kadesh Ishech Yadbek Elech Yaveh, you thought that through this now your husband will want you and more be more desirous of you. Hine lo yakain, also not true. Tamir Elishech Tet Shukasech Lhu Yim Shabach. You thought you're gonna, so to speak, have this to hang over your husband, he'll always want you, he'll be following you around. So Hashem, no, I'm gonna make it in such a way that even if he may be desirous of you, but you may have even in that same realm, you're going to be just as desirous of him, if not more. Plus, in light of the Midrashim we saw, perhaps, whether it's your inability to communicate it or otherwise, it's going to put you, that very aspect is going to put you at a disadvantage. And again, to me, this is fascinating and almost prescient because, you know, if you read some of the literature nowadays, we know that certainly historically, this was always the case, right? That when you speak, you know, in which direction was there more sexual exploitation? It's always, unfortunately, I mean, no, I don't mean this is an apostrophe, of course this is terrible, but that's a reality. That's exactly what the environmental says. And again, this is so fascinating, it's proto-feminist. Because the way he reads into Chava's mindset, you thought you'll have this to lord over the man. And you see that sometimes now, right, people you read, you know, modern thinkers, and again, it's in the modern world we live in, this has changed a little bit, not entirely, of course, where so to speak, women use this as a strength to have over men. So that's what he says Chava had in mind. But no, the reality of human history has been just the opposite. Says the Barbanel, that was the Mida Keneged Mida that Hashem punished Chava with. And all these things, says the Barbanel, Hadvar Ma'elu, Nischarshu Acharachay. None of these things would have been if it wouldn't have been for Chava's sin. Sha'isha, Lamasha Nasta, Etze Meha Adam, Ubasim Rib Saro, says the Barbanel, all of these things that we think about and we know about, so that women are emotionally different than men, psychologically different, physiologically different, says the Abarbanel, none of this was supposed to be. Originally, the original Chava, the first two prokim of the Torah, was more or less, identical in temperament and psychology to Adam, as it would have been throughout history, men and women. However, as a result of the sin, that changed. That's what he says here on the last line, that in the beginning, Basar Mipsaro, Mezgah ke mezgah, their temperaments, their emotional states were the same. She didn't have any more weaknesses than him, any more psychological issues, nothing. Everything we're talking about, which obviously, again, we're focusing, unfortunately, and I feel terrible about the imbalance, but we're focusing at this point on the negative aspects. Of course, there are obviously many wonderful and charming aspects to the feminine personality. But all of these emotional or physiological realities, which are unique to women, that are difficult and make things difficult, says the Barbanel, they're all a result of the sin. But originally, none of them would have happened because there wouldn't have been these differences. Men and women would have been, other than the basic, the physiological difference, biological difference, other than that very basic thing, we often say, you know, why assume? I myself have said this sometimes in Kiruv or in Chinuch contexts, that we generally assume that men and women have different temperaments. And I've always often thought that it's intuitive. Why would you think that it would just be reproductive organs that are different? You know, but I'm only half right, in the sense that I'm right in the reality of the world that we're living in, I hope. But I'm not right in the sense that theoretically it could have been just that. That would have been just one little detail. Right? The baby comes out of the mother. The mother can nurse. That would be about it. But says the Barbanel, everything else would have been the same. So even though this has some overlap to the Medrash, as the Netziv a little bit, but both the Netziv and the Abarbanel, each in their own way, are really striking out and giving broader and very different original ideas to the understanding of the punishment of Chava. I just want to close, because it would be criminal and negligent almost to leave anybody with any mistaken impressions, that as a result of all of this, and getting back now to my son and his misunderstanding of Chumash, and my daughter's correct intuition at 3 or 4,
4 of the reality of the world. So just so we should know, what is the ideal marriage? What should it be? Is there this imbalance? Is there some power thing? And as I said before, it's chas v'shalom. It's the furthest thing from the truth. It's normal and it's okay for a first grader to make that mistake. But if he or anyone else wouldn't grow out of that, it would be a terrible thing. And it would be a violation of the Rambam. If you just take a look, we'll conclude with this. We're no longer in Chumash Perushim, but just in more general Hashkafa. So the Rambam tells us in back-to-back halachos the respect and the role that a woman should have for her husband and that a husband should have for his wife. So the Rambam says in Halacha Yutes, Adam mechabed es ishto yoser migufo. A man has to honor his wife even more than himself. But ohavo kegufo, and he must love her at least as much as he loves himself. Im yesh lo mamon, and if he can afford it, marbe v'tavasa, he should use that money to shower gifts upon her, etc. Ki mamon. Again, sometimes we have people who want to spend a lot more than their husbands can earn. I've been aware of that problem too. But responsibly, he should be using any discretionary income he has to shower his wife with gifts. That is part of the obligation of a Jewish husband. And furthermore, I just this week had a Shalom Bais issue where if I could, the problem is that the husband doesn't want to talk to me and the woman's too scared to tell her husband that she did speak to me. But as she was talking, I was about the fear that she has of her husband, I was thinking of this Rambam. And this is not about physical, just emotional fear, not physical abuse, chas v'shalom. But this is almost as bad. V'lo yatil ala ema yisera. Once you hear the word fear describing a relationship and a marriage, there's already massive red flags. There shouldn't be fear. That's not what a relationship is supposed to be about. V'ya dibura ima benachas. You don't raise your voice at your spouse. Your husband doesn't raise his voice at his wife. You speak to her nicely. And then, the more difficult thing, Rabbi Willig always quotes this next to last phrase, lo ye'atzav. It's an avera for a husband to be sad. Why? Because what happens when the husband's sad? His wife gets sad, sometimes more sad than him. So it's a chiyuv on a husband to be as happy as possible, at least when he's around his wife, because otherwise he's going to make her sad. This is part of the obligation of a husband. If lo ra'ag, then he shouldn't be angry. This is what a man's supposed to be. This is right, not Yehu Yim Shalbach. On the contrary, all of these things. Now, again, you shouldn't think it's one-sided either. It's reciprocal. A woman also has to have things towards her husband. So, for example, says the Rambam in the next halacha, Al Isha Shetiyeh Mechaberes Es Baila B'Yosher Midai. A woman has to have great honor for her husband. Although, again, that's not exactly as far as it said in the previous halacha, where he has to have honor for her even more than himself. This is just great honor. But it's pretty close. V'yelo Alea Mora, she should have reverence for him, respect for him. Patasa Koma Se'al Piv, she should try to do things that are in accordance with what she knows he would want. V'yeneha, and this is very interesting and potentially controversial, I'll tell you, I'm going to set my third story I'm going to tell you now. V'yeneha Kamosar Omelech. She should have such reverence for him that she should see him as almost like a king. So not long ago, this is 6-7 years ago, maybe it was 8 years ago, in Tradition magazine they had a symposium on issues relating to women, modern women, traditional Judaism, Orthodoxy, and some of the challenges which you all know about. And they had a symposium of a number of different writers. As it so happens, they picked a writer who was more to the right, if you will, more Haredi world, that are traditionally the people who are writing in Tradition, and he was very articulate, very well. One of the things he mentioned was that he knows in particular, I think he says a Kolo couple or something, he says they have the most wonderful marriage, and what's their secret? She views her husband as the Rosh Hashiva of the house. That was the terminology used. So it's interesting that in the letters to the editor in the next edition, people were commenting about everything. But this one drew the most fire. People were apocalyptic. How could you talk this way? It's like that modern. Well, gosh, he's the Rosh Hashiva. What kind of business is this? So I smiled when I read it, and I just looked up. I said, makes perfect sense to me. A husband should be the Rosh Hashiva, but the wife is the Mashgiach. And we all know who runs the yeshiva. Like, that was my cute little bon mot on that idea. You know, you want to call me the Rosh Hashiva? Great. But what's the difference? It's just the title. That doesn't mean I run anything. So, again, his idea, but it's just to be fair, this person who was writing in that symposium, he didn't make it up. Come from the Rambam. That's what the Rambam says. But just.
Because there's an option of
Yira. Right. Which you did not see when it came to a man towards his wife. That's correct.
You don't see that
in Rambam. Oh. We're not talking about fear. Chas v'shalom. Yeah, it's
It's awe or respect. So just to conclude, this is what he says so beautifully at the end. He says, "Vezehu derech benos Yisrael ubenei Yisrael akadoshim." These two things that I've said, this is the way a man should treat his wife, and this is the way a wife should treat her husband. Hatahara mezivugah. And this is, if you want to have kedusha and tahara, again, in a healthy and holy marriage, this is you have to do that. Ubedrachim elu yeshuva no meshubach. Not just holy and pure. We're about human needs too, but it'll also be a wonderful, pleasant marriage. If you have, again, so all of these are details. The basic idea, which we can sum up in one idiomatic English phrase: mutual respect, and a balance of respect, not an imbalance. Chas v'shalom, there's nothing like that. Anytime you have anyone, like, especially if you're the man, but even if it's the woman, she shouldn't be lording over her husband either. Anything like that is already signs of an unhealthy marriage. Any fear in either direction, even if it's just a fear of an emotional reprisal or anger and temper, these are all red flags, anything unhealthy. And shalom, and anyone who tells you this is what the Torah has in mind, this is what Ashkafas the Torah is, it's just as that very same Rebbe has taught my son well to say, there's more baloney in that than in Wasserman and Lemberger.